Welcome to the Boulder City Podcast. I'm Roger Gross, the host of the program, and today we have Art Mayer-Terris with us, the legendary sports book operator and also a resident of Boulder City. Art, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Roger. Good to see you.
So, congratulations on your retirement. You've labored for a long time in the sportsbook field and certainly have gained an incredible reputation over the years. So how is the retirement going to change your life?
Oh, it's changing my life in significant ways already.
Yeah.
I'm trying to de-stress and trying to, ratchet down the intensity that becomes part of your life on a daily basis.
Sure.
In the casino industry. And it's hard to turn the off switch, activate the off switch.
Sure, I can imagine.
I'm only a week or so into this, but already I am enjoying myself. I am walking and hiking and biking and all the things that I've missed out on for the last 30 or 40 years.
Great. Well, Boulder City is a great place to do it.
It sure is. The trails all around town are magnificent.
Sure.
The weather, of course, is beautiful. It's not too hot yet in the season, so I'm really enjoying myself and enjoying some of the my family members that I rarely got to see under normal circumstances.
Yeah. Well, that's great. You do look a lot more relaxed now. I'm glad to see
I
that.
Feel a lot more relaxed without sweating big decisions every night and going to bed watching scores come in and then looking at results first thing in the morning. So that's a big change in lifestyle to move on from that.
So sports betting, when you started out, was pretty much an amenity in a casino. When you compare the revenue of the casino to the sportsbook revenue, it's pretty almost insignificant when it comes to the overall revenue. But it was an amenity to bring people in. So how shocked were you to see sports betting, grow so rapidly in the last 3 years since the repeal of PASPA?
Well, there's been a lot of things that have surprised me since the repeal of PASPA. First of all, PASPA becoming the law of the land surprised me 28 years ago when that happened. I was around at that time, obviously, when PASPA became law, and saw how it was proposed and pushed forward and ultimately passed and signed into law. It was a mistake at the time.
Right.
Not valid reasons, in my opinion, for that law passing. Mm-hmm. But at Hilton Hotels at that time, where I was, we had successfully merged wagering pools between the Las Vegas Hilton Superbook and the Flamingo Hilton on the Las Vegas Strip. And it was an easy project. It was an easy solution. We were able to run both properties simultaneously from one central location, and it really laid the blueprint of what could happen in Las Vegas and the U.S. and around the world, really. So we had the idea of going to racetracks and putting in sports betting at racetracks in those years.
Right.
And there was some interest by various racetracks in doing that.
Sure.
There were other racetracks that were adamantly opposed. Mm-hmm. And those that were opposed were very influential, and they were able to rally support in opposition of sports betting expanding beyond Nevada borders.
Okay.
The reality is, though, once PASPA became the law of the land, it didn't change the business model in Nevada very much.
Right.
We maintained the status quo. We had a growing business before, and we had a growing business after it became law. But I have been surprised since PASPA fell. Not surprised PASPA did fall once it reached the Supreme Court.
Right.
The hard part was getting it to the Supreme Court. But those that pushed it, were relentless and stuck with it, and until they ultimately reached the highest court in the land, and then all momentum shifted. Then they went from a long shot to a favorite in having it overturned, and I have been a little bit disappointed that the expansion of sports has not more closely followed the Nevada model.
Right.
We've gone through growing pains here. Mm-hmm. We've had tremendous experience, a lot of talent around town, a lot of technical solutions around town, and of course the regulatory infrastructure and experience of operating sports betting for a half a century.
Right.
So certain states that jumped into the business and streamlined regulations and made things a little bit faster to market multiple skins, as they're called, or access points. Those things surprised me. The league involvement in sports gambling has certainly surprised me. Not that there wasn't a path forward for the leagues. There certainly was, but the extent of the change in strategy and philosophy by the leagues has surprised me.
Okay. Yeah, and as you say, every state seems to have its own little blueprint that they're following, and why they didn't even pick up Nevada or even New Jersey, for that matter, is a mystery to me.
Yeah, myself as well. I've seen certain regulations in certain jurisdictions, and I'm not going to point fingers individually at those states or their regulatory structure, but I will say that I've seen some that I think are really misguided.
Yeah, no question. Well, let's go back to the beginning of the early days of sports betting in Vegas. This probably even predates you, which is saying a lot. You know? But the fact that the casinos didn't really take sports bets early on. I mean, you had to go across the street and go to a little dingy little sports book to place those bets. And what do you think that changed?
Well, there was federal tax law changes that prompted the growth of sports gambling in Nevada. When I joined the industry in the late 70s. Mm-hmm. There was a 2% federal excise tax on handle.
Okay.
So 2% of handle was to be paid in federal tax. That's a lot.
Big. That's
huge. Yeah.
Sure.
So that the casinos were very hesitant to get in the business before that. U.S. Senator Howard Cannon from Nevada. Mm-hmm. I consider the father of our industry.
Okay.
I really do, because he proposed the legislation changing that 2.0% federal excise tax to 0.25% and somehow got it through, which was a miracle.
Yeah,
imagine bipartisan support today to reduce federal gambling handle tax in one state. I would assume that would be enormously challenging to get through the legislature.
Absolutely, yeah.
But he did. He navigated it through, and once that law changed, that's when you saw the boom of sports books in the casino business, to get into the casino business.
Okay.
Prior to that, it was standalone sports books almost exclusively.
Right, okay. And people would go across the street and make their bets, and a lot of times they'd hang out and watch the games there, too, so I guess the casinos wanted to bring them back into the house, huh?
Yeah, sure. They did. But in fact, even at the Las Vegas Hilton, when I started at the Las Vegas Hilton, in the mid '80s, it was a giant hotel, a giant convention property, but no sports book. Of course, a full casino and slot departments and poker no poker. They built poker at the time of opening the Superbook in December of 1986.
Mm-hmm.
But what that property was experiencing before I got there, as I came to understand, was that guests were leaving on weekends.
Yeah.
They're leaving, on football weekends, they're going elsewhere. Mm-hmm. They're going up to the Strip, to Caesars and other properties. And the same on, with college basketball tournament and NBA playoffs and, everything. They were losing a lot of bodies.
Mm-hmm.
That was unsustainable. They had to stop the bleeding. So that property went from no sports book to all of a sudden a giant full service, full scale race and sports book that they of course called the Superbook, and put in a major poker room at that time too.
Sure,
so all of that was incremental business, and it was real easy to see. It was real easy to track in that case, the differences in hotel revenues and occupancy and casino revenues and casino drops and so on. And the differences, the year over year differences after opening the race and sports book were just dramatic across the board.
No question. So you started out at probably was the most iconic sports book of its day, the Stardust.
Yeah.
They really set the line. I mean, I remember I lived on the East Coast at the time, it was the Stardust line, you know.
Yeah,
and a friend of mine just told me a story about a bank of payphones opposite the sports book. He said they were the 10th most profitable set of payphones in the country.
Yeah, so. Yeah, I remember that bank of payphones. Actually, that was my second job. I did start at the Fremont downtown.
Okay.
So spent a year running around downtown as a kid. Mm-hmm. I had just turned 21. Then moved up to the Stardust, an affiliated property. Mm-hmm. That was a very interesting time, to put it mildly, right. at the Stardust in those years. Great experience, a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. Left at the right time, I think, and had the opportunity to really learn the business at the Barbary Coast under my uncle Jack Franzi, Pittsburgh Jack, and Jimmy Vaccaro.
Okay.
My cousin Chris Andrews, also well-known local bookmaker.
Is he at South Point now?
He's at South Point. Right. Yeah. We followed a very similar path. Mm-hmm. Our cousin Zach. Came out with us also, or we all came out within a few months of one another, all got into the business one way or another. Zach on the other side of the counter for most of his career. He's jumped back and forth a couple of times, though, but he's a very talented handicapper and odds maker in his own right, and sportsbook operator.
Right. Were you ever tempted to make the jump?
Once I got into management, no.
Yeah.
Once I got into management, I became sportsbook manager at Caesar's Palace, mm-hmm. I said that I've got to be on one side of the counter or the other.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to try to do both. I'm not going to try to use use inside knowledge. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to run to other sports books or to the phone somewhere to capitalize on any information that's coming my way. That's just not that's not going to happen for me.
Sure.
And I made that decision to make a clean break, and I maintained that.
Yeah.
Now that I'm not working full time in the industry, who knows?
You don't know. That's right. Well, you get a lot more information these days from right on Twitter, I think.
Yeah.
So tell us about Caesars. Caesars was also a very popular sports book in those days, and they had a great sports book area within their casino there. What was that like working for them?
Oh, I loved that. What could be more fun? I remember pinching myself a number of times when I was at Caesars saying, they're actually paying me for this. We had the biggest fights in the world.
Right.
Hagler Hearns, for example. Yeah. I was at ringside for that and some of the other great, great fights of that era.
Okay.
Just a blast of a job for a young man. Mm-hmm. And loved the guys that I was working with. Had an opportunity to learn more, of course. But I worked very hard when I got there, and it was talk about life-changing experiences. That was when I went from a kid to an adult executive.
Mm-hmm.
Almost overnight.
Yeah.
And my lifestyle changed, my work habits changed dramatically, and I'm not exaggerating when I say when I went in there for the first 6 months that I was there, I honestly think I worked every single day and most days over 12 hours for 6 months straight. And there was a great opportunity to turn that property around. Mm-hmm. The way the book was run, that was what I was brought in there to do.
Sure.
And I think I successfully did that, and I think I earned the reputation for myself of as a hard worker and competent and talented in this particular field. And then they started construction on a new book while I was there. Mm-hmm. Which I was in the middle of, and which was another tremendous learning opportunity.
Sure.
So my experience at Caesars was nothing but fun and rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
Although I was only there for 2.5 years,
mm-hmm.
Before taking the job at the Hilton to oversee construction of the Superbook.
Okay.
And then did 15 years at Hilton Hotels, which was a pretty long stretch, and I loved it. But then did another 20 at Station Casinos after that.
For sure.
Yeah.
Who was president of Caesars when you were there?
When I started, it was Harry Wald.
Okay.
When I left, it was Don Allison.
Okay.
Don, yeah. Do you remember?
Yeah, I just wanted to get some context there. Terry Lanny came in at some point also.
He was the president of Caesars World time.
The big company, right?
Yes, the parent company.
Right. Yeah. I knew him from...
He and Henry Gluck were the top two guys at Caesars World. And Harry Wald, I remember, like it was yesterday, walking into his office at Caesar's Palace, and you know, he had such this aura about him, mm-hmm. you know, with that white, perfect hair, and it looked like a scene from the Blues Brothers, right. when they see the nun with the halo around her, sure. and the aura about her, and that, you know, yeah, so it was pretty intimidating for a kid to be in Harry Wald's office. But he left shortly thereafter, and had worked with Don Allison. But it was mainly the great casino operator Moki Facento, Al Facento, who hired me, mm-hmm. and taught me a lot, and who I came to love the most, yeah. at Caesars. And I was fortunate enough that right across the street, competitor, Barbary Coast, Michael Gaughan, right. recommended me, yeah. to Moki. Hmm. And that's one thing led to another, yeah. and that's how I wound up there.
Michael's got a good eye for good executives, you know.
Yeah, oh yeah. And the people that work for him, have a real sense of loyalty to him. He's endeared himself to many, many casino executives, sure. around town, as have the Fertittas.
Sure.
Certainly well-loved and respected and appreciated by many of their,
right.
The executives that have come out of that organization, especially for their father, Frank Jr., who was, you know, really, really well-respected by his employees.
Sure. So let's talk about your time at Station. You were around, you know, when they were building some of their, I guess around Green Valley Ranch time? Is that what?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's, yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Green Valley Ranch was under construction, right. when I started.
And then Red Rock, of course, their flagship right now.
Yep.
Did you have like input into how they designed the sports book and things like that?
Yeah, but the truth of the matter is, though, that very highest levels of the company have tremendous eyes for detail and tremendous,
sure.
Design capabilities. Mm-hmm. So their insights and observations and recommendations and original drafts, mm-hmm. Were very strong.
Right.
So there really was a great blueprint to work with, mm-hmm. when I got there for Green Valley Ranch, and a few, and you know, some years later, Red Rock. Mm-hmm. But of course, I did get to work on the details and the,
sure.
and the sight lines a little bit, and the, mm-hmm. Technology,
sure, the
video
type
technology,
of screen and views and things like that.
Yeah, yeah. And the, yeah. seating and, right. and so on and so forth. But the overall, it was part of the overall property design, which Red Rock, the entire Red Rock properties were the best designed casino that I know of in Las Vegas.
Yeah, no question about that. So when you were at the Hilton, you launched the Super Contest, which has become really legendary. I mean,
yeah.
thousands of people enter it every year. I think they almost had $20 million in prizes last year.
Yeah. Yeah, it became really bigger than I ever could have imagined.
Yeah.
I did start the Super Contest, and I did help it grow in, mm-hmm. the early days. That's all true. But I wish I could say that I came up with the idea myself.
Right.
I really did not. There was a small standalone sports book on the Strip in those just prior to the launch of the Super Contest called the Castaways. And
right.
the Castaways had a well-known sports book operator, Sonny Reisner,
mm-hmm.
Who was pretty popular and a pretty quick-witted guy. And he did a lot of media interviews, and he was pretty well-known, well-liked guy in town. He started what was called the Challenge at the Castaways,
right.
and it looked like a really good format to, mm-hmm. to me. And a couple years later, I wind up at the Hilton, and the Castaways closes.
Mm-hmm.
It became the part of the property for the building of the Mirage.
Right, right, yep.
So now all of a sudden, that contest that was just taking root was available, that type of format. So it was then that I grabbed that concept, mm-hmm. and turned it into the Super Contest, and then helped it grow. And then, of course, over the years, there's been a number of innovations and expansions,
sure,
and,
right.
and it's just continued to grow ever since. And the same thing with the Station Casino's Last Man Standing,
right.
contest,
yes.
which were very successful.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Very, very popular contest. Again, though, I did not come up with the concept.
Mm-hmm.
One of my guys did.
Yeah.
One of our sportsbook managers came up with the concept for his individual property, and once I saw it, I said, "Oh, this is great! You know,
yeah,
this is great. We have to use this for the whole company."
Yeah.
You know, and we did, and then we rolled it out company wide, and have and it's grown. That has also grown ever since, both in college football, pro football,
sure,
and college basketball tournament.
Well, just a few years ago, the station does this every year, but the football pool that you put out every year, and you have to go in and choose your six or seven teams you liked each week, and that always brought me into just to enter that contest.
The Great Giveaway?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the Great Giveaway was a really successful, popular promotion,
right,
we're very, very well known and very well,
sure,
accepted around town for many, many years. That's been on hiatus now for a little while,
yeah,
and may come back in the not too distant future. But, as the world changes and, certainly some new technology and new innovations and new delivery methods, mm-hmm, have to be explored for future mass football contests.
Okay. So Station was one of the first Nevada companies to introduce mobile sports betting.
Yep.
How did you, what was it like to go through the process of figuring out how that would work?
Well, the company is very technology oriented,
right,
and very, aggressive in identifying trends,
mm-hmm,
and knowing where things are going in business and trying to be out in front of technology,
mm-hmm,
and it was a natural for that the company to be out in front of remote gambling also,
right,
and they,
right,
and they continue to be, and
mm-hmm,
they're going to be continuing to move in that direction now too, and will long after I'm gone.
Yeah.
And,
mm-hmm. What's your opinion of the sports betting apps? I find them pretty rudimentary right now. There's not a lot of bells and whistles on them, and some of them are really hard to navigate. Do you think there's going to be a moment where there's going to be a great leap forward, and people are going to figure it out?
I have a different perspective than most on, mm-hmm, on the apps. Most and probably the more we talk, and we've actually discussed this a little bit in the past, that I consider myself a contrarian in a lot of ways.
Right.
And right now, there's so much focus on messaging on mobile apps,
right,
mobile sports gambling apps, and there's so much emphasis on promotions and contests and so on, and those things are all great, and I don't mean, mm-hmm, to diminish or belittle the validity of those opinions, but as a bookmaker, a lifelong, mm-hmm, career bookmaker, an app has one function at the end of the day, and that's to take a bet,
mm-hmm,
and,
right,
pay a bet.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they exist for.
Right.
And an app to me can have all the bells and whistles you can imagine. It can have all these great tools. It can have all these comical messages and ingenious ways of reaching guests and so on and so forth. But if a guy can't bet when he wants to bet, what he wants to bet on, then it's failed.
Mm-hmm.
And so the most reliable apps are the most impressive to me,
right,
and the one and the quickest that allow a guest to get on the app and make his bet are the best to me,
mm-hmm,
and all that other stuff is secondary.
Yeah No, I agree, that's a problem. It's hard to find the things you want to bet on, and then if you have to dig down through different layers to find it, and I imagine someday they're going to have customized sports bets where you can just go right to the kind of bets you want to make, and then you don't even have to deal with that other stuff.
Yeah There are some that have in their settings,
sure,
different ways to expedite the process,
mm-hmm,
and certainly you're right. You're right though, Roger, that having it appeal or having it fit the guest preference is what they need to do. And some have partial ability to do that now, and some,
right,
I think,
sure,
are going to work move in that direction.
Yeah, no question. I think they'll figure it out pretty quickly here. Station was I don't want to say reluctant, but I think. Station's concept is always to bring people into the property, and if you can bet at home, are you going to come in? But there's ways that you can attract people to the sports book through the app. So do you think that's been developed enough yet?
No, not yet. I think that there is a way to go and to capitalize on both. Now, I always envision myself as a very guest service focused,
right,
sportsbook operator, but that mostly meant historically the retail customers, the walk-in customers. And in today's world, with most properties, most companies, I'm sure, would tell you that the majority of their business is now remote in in sports, not walking in the door. So that is a whole new area of guest service focus for the industry. And that's something that all book operators can improve on. It's something that I know, you know, we were working on very hard at stations before I left to try to improve that area of operations, and I'm sure they're continuing to move in that direction. I know they'll get it right eventually.
So you mentioned the deals being made between sports books and leagues and pro teams and everything, and I'm a little confused about you know what each side gets out of that. Obviously, you know, sometimes you get a book right in a stadium or something like that. But you know, if you've seen, of course, the football, the soccer leagues in Europe, they've got sports betting sponsorships on their jerseys. You know, so
just south of our border in Mexico,
too. Sure. So you know, do you think that is beneficial to both the sports leagues and the sports books?
I have mixed feelings about that. I really do. I've always been an advocate for sports gambling, of course, and I've always recognized and promoted the ability of bookmakers, myself included, to serve in a policing agency, in maintaining the integrity of sports. I didn't envision an industry coming into the U.S. For integrity monitoring. I envisioned bookmakers doing that because that's what we've always done. We're the ones at risk. We're the ones that pay the price if there ever is a problem. But they are so few and far between in the U.S. as compared to other parts of the world. And when you start to ask yourself, why do other parts of the world have these problems and the U.S. doesn't? Then I have serious misgivings about the closeness of leagues and gambling. I always thought that that degree of separation was necessary for the benefit of both industries. That philosophy seems to have gone out the window now in recent years.
Well, we seem to see already a little backlash in Europe. I mean, the UK is talking about banning sports betting on the jerseys, and they're also banning advertising, until the nighttime. And that's what I'm concerned about. I mean, do you think sports betting is getting overexposed in this country, kind of the way DFS was when it first started?
That analogy is a fair one.
Yeah.
And after 60 years of nationwide sports gambling in the UK, why are they taking those steps now, and why are things rolling back the other way there? Both countries, are going in exact opposite directions now. And when we understand all the reasons to why that's happening, why the UK is rolling back, I might give you a fair model to say that we don't want that to happen here.
Right. So how did you approach responsible gaming when you were running Sportsbook? I mean, obviously you'd see people come in and bet a lot of money. Some of them could afford it. But you could also tell when somebody was obsessed by it. Was there something you did to back people off when you saw that happening?
Yeah, there's, the information cards the call-in, the hotline numbers and so forth have to be distributed, have to be shown, have to be, we wound up putting them on sheets and wagering tickets so on and so forth. But it's a tough problem. It's a tough problem to deal with. And if you were selling cars or selling widgets and somebody keeps buying a lot of widgets, your business sense is to keep selling them widgets. In the case of that you're referencing here, it can become a problem. It does become a problem with some people, and we are as operators obligated to be on the lookout for it and don't let things get to that extreme, and to intervene if and when necessary.
Sure. How about the sharp bettors? I mean, it's always been fascinated me. People like Billy Walters and those kind of level people coming in and betting these tremendous amounts of money. How did you do anything to control them? Are there any people that you wouldn't allow to bet?
Well, there are people that we would control or restrict, but they were, it was never because of wins and losses, and that's a common fallacy that he's winning, so he's got restricted or he got thrown out because he's winning. That's not the case. Mm-hmm. What happens is guests call attention to themselves, and my operations, I always envision myself as being very, very regulatory compliant oriented.
Sure.
And the understanding state laws and regulations and understanding certain federal laws, Wire Act in particular, always led me to maintain a very strict interpretation of the regulations and the laws.
Right.
And if you look at it that way, when guests appear to be approaching a questionable status in the transfer of information and so on and so forth, then enforcing those regulations because someone gets on your radar because of the manner in which they're operating, that would both protect the business, the house, the individuals involved, myself personally, and the team members that would be dealing with those particular guests. So I always looked at it as a regulatory control issue, not a financial result issue in dealing with that segment of the market.
Yeah.
And Las Vegas certainly has a very high percentage of sophisticated play compared to other parts of the world and other parts of the U.S.
So just one more question: What's next for Art Mayor Terrace?
Well, I don't know yet.
Yeah.
I don't know yet. I really, really am looking forward to the next few years. I think they're certainly going to be impactful in my life in a lot of ways. It already is. But I'm not ready for the rocking chair entirely just yet. I love traveling the world. Mm-hmm. I've seen you in many parts of the world.
Right.
But I love seeing what's going on in the UK. I talked to somebody from Rome today, and we were talking about what's going on there. And everywhere I go, whether it's Dublin, Athens, some of the islands, I'm always looking at what's going on in sports gambling in various parts of the world. I can't wait to start doing that again. With the virus receding, travel opening up, it's the perfect opportunity for me to get back out there and see what's going on. There are some possibilities that entice me a little bit. I certainly don't want to work for a big company and be a full-time operations leader. That doesn't appeal to me at all. If I wanted to do that, I would, I would have been content.
You'd certainly be a well sought after consultant, I would think.
Yeah. There's been several companies that have reached out already about different possibilities.
Yeah.
I told my wife says that sitting on a board and giving advice, that could be right up my alley. I'm pretty good at that.
So, actually, one more question. People might think it's strange that one of the world's leading bookmakers ended up settling in a town in Nevada, the only town in Nevada that has no gambling. What attracted you to Boulder City?
Well, I do love Boulder City, and my parents had retired here. They came from Pittsburgh in their later years and settled in Boulder City. So I really didn't have too much familiarity with it before that.
Right.
I was living in Las Vegas at the time, but once I started spending time here, I loved it. And once my kids were reaching junior high, the older kids were reaching junior high age, I wanted to get them in the schools out here. Still part of Clark County School District, of course, but a much different environment, in my opinion, from what I saw and knew. I wanted to get them in the schools out here was the primary reason for coming out, but then just fell in love with the town.
Yeah, well, that's the reason I moved here, too, to get my kids in the school, and they seem to have done pretty well. So I'm glad you're here, glad we like our little small town. And Art, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it. It's good to see you, and congratulations and good luck in the future. And please keep us informed about what you're doing. We'd like to do this again. I could talk for hours about this, and we'll do it some other time.
Roger, thank you so much. Glad to talk to you anytime, and I enjoyed the conversation also.
for listening to the Boulder City Podcast, brought to you by Railroad Pass, Boulder City's hometown casino. For more information on Railroad Pass, visit railroadpass.com. And come visit Boulder City for the time of your life. Don't miss my column in the Boulder City Review. And we'll see you next time on the Boulder City Podcast.